The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Global Development Podcast. I'm Hugh Muir. This month, something different. We'll be returning to some of the people and issues we've talked about this year and finding out what happened next. We'll also be touching on what we can expect in 2015. We've updates on Ebola in West Africa and how the world looks after climate change talks in Peru. There's what happened after we uncovered corruption in Mali. NATO pulled out of Afghanistan. How will that impact on development there? All of that coming up and more on this bumper Global Development Podcast from The Guardian. And we begin this month's podcast where we left the last, Lima, and the COP20 climate change talks in Peru. You'll have read the gist of it by now. Pretty hopeful, a key first step, but plenty left to do. Let's unpick that summary now with The Guardian's US environment correspondent Suzanne Goldenberg. She's in Peru now. And our environment editor, John Vidal. He's here with me in London. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hi.
Suzanne, let me start with you. We expected a compromise, one that no one was really happy with, that got us closer to a deal. Is that basically what we've got?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've got an agreement that came out at the 11th hour that everybody is unhappy with. So if that's the definition of a compromise, then this is a compromise deal.
Is that what was likely, that everyone was going to come out of this happy? One would have thought not.
Oh, no, no. Everyone's unhappy. Everyone's a little bit unhappy.
And isn't that what you thought going into it? That's where we would be.
You know, what I think happened is that everyone's optimism was boosted going into the talks because there had been this deal between the two biggest carbon polluters, the U.S. and China, and money had, they agreed between them to cut emissions. Money had begun to sort of dribble into the Green Climate Fund. There was a sense of momentum. So then people thought, well, maybe for once we can actually accomplish something at these talks. And then, you know, in the inevitable sort of roller coaster arc of these things, we thought the talks would collapse. And they did actually emerge with something that that ticked the boxes for the big sort of constituent blocks here. So I think there are some good things that come out of this, judging, you know, by the sort of very modest standards that we have come to expect from such
John
meetings.
Vidal, here in London, all countries will have to make cuts in carbon use. Is that enough? Is that enough to make you happy?
Yeah, I mean, it probably is a very good thing, but frankly, these are voluntary cuts. So every country will be able to choose effectively what it wants to do, what it can do. So we're going to get lowest common denominator stuff, and we've no idea if that's going to be in total anywhere near enough to get us down to the maximum of 1 degree, 2 degree centigrade rise in temperatures, which the cuts will need. I can't personally see it happening. I think all countries by end of March are going to have to say what they're going to cut, and then by November next year, the UN will have crunched those figures and we'll be able to see exactly whether we're on target or not to keep the temperatures down. And I fear we'll be well, well, well away, and there'll be an almighty confrontation in Paris next year.
It's voluntary, not binding. Who do we have to keep an eye on? Who would like to be the laggards here?
Well, take your pick.
I suppose it's good that they had some sort of agreed text, but it does seem to water down previous commitments, Suzanne, on cutting greenhouse gas emissions. You've written one particular phrase, common but differentiated responsibilities. What's that about?
Ah, that is what they call the firewall. Basically, 20 years ago, when the international community began dealing with this issue, there was this idea that, you know, the countries responsible for the problem, which is the U.S. and Europe, the rich countries, industrialized world, should take responsibility for climate change, that they should be the ones that should cut emissions. Now, what's happened since then is that countries like China, India, Brazil have begun to develop, and they've begun to do so and to grow their economies on a very polluting path. And in fact, China now produces more greenhouse gas emissions than the United States. So the United States has managed, and to a lesser extent, Europe has managed to reshape the nature of these talks so that from here on in, China, India, and other countries are going to have to cut their emissions as well. So that's a big deal that language is in there. You also see a subclause in there. So common but differentiated responsibilities means that China and the other emerging economies don't have to do as much as the U.S. And then there's another subclause that says, well, they actually do have to do something. So that's a big deal.
That's the devil in the detail, though, isn't it, John? The differentiated responsibilities. One can see people, countries arguing about that until the year dot.
Hugh, it's the key to the whole thing, because what's happened is they've built up this enormous resentment by the poor countries now are absolutely furious that the rich countries are not going to have to lead anymore. And this is unjust. This is a climate injustice of the first order. And so they're not going to let them get away with that in Paris next year.
That's interesting, because when you read the headlines, you kind of think, oh, well, that's good. Everyone has a common level of responsibility. But in one way, it's just the big countries palming off some level of their responsibilities, the smaller ones, isn't it?
No, it's not, because what you've got is historical responsibility as well. So all the mess we've got ourselves into now is not actually very much to do with China and India. It's much more to do with what happened 50, 100 years ago in Europe and America and the industrialized countries. Now, in the past, those countries took historical responsibility and said they would lead the world out of this mess. And now what's happened is that, as Suzanne has rightfully said, it's everybody's responsibility. The poor countries,
that just mean no one's leading.
The poor countries don't mind cutting their emissions. I mean, that's not a great problem. I mean, they want money to help them and everything like that. But they do mind if the rich countries don't take a lead. And that's what we're not seeing. And that will be the fault line later on, I think.
Suzanne, is that the nightmare that the poor countries go away with a piece of paper and it all looks very good, and then they get home and they read it and they think, oh, this is not what we thought it was. This is not as good as we thought it was.
Well, first of all, what I want to say is that what I found interesting about this particular COP, which is what they call these annual meetings, was that I don't think you can, and this isn't a success for US and European diplomacy in a way, in that I don't see that those distinctions quite so clearly between rich and poor countries. You've got the alliance of poor countries has begun to fracture in all sorts of different ways. So you have big developing countries such as India, China, Brazil, and South Africa. Then you've got this group of Latin American countries such as Peru and Mexico and Colombia that, you know, are going along with the U.S. line quite clearly, to the extent that they're putting money into climate finance, you know, that they are now sort of in some intermediate rich-poor group where they are helping to pay for other countries. So you've got India, China, the big developing countries, you've got the middle countries, and you've got the poorest of the poor countries that have also been co-opted a little bit by the United States. So the big divide of rich country, poor country is shifting around a bit. And I think that is why the US and Europe have been able to sort of reshape this conversation into this idea that everybody has to do their fair share, rather then, look, we've been the cause of the problem.
But I think the danger is that we've got now very little negotiating time left before we get this supposed final deal in Paris. So, and it's not in anybody's interest to sign up to a deal which is not going to help them in any way. The big other elephant in the room is the finances, the money. And here, the rich countries have really come up with derisory offers. I mean, Suzanne wrote a very good piece about this. I mean,
give us some idea.
Basically, it's a quarter of what they raised before. In 2010, 2011, 2012, they managed to get $10 billion a year. Now, after saying, woohoo, green climate fund, they've managed to get $10 billion over 4 years. And some of that is not new money. Some of that is just moving money from one pot to the other, especially with Australia. And yet developing countries are supposed to take from this some kind of reassurance that somehow the rich countries and the middle income countries are going to sort of mobilize enough money to reach $100 billion every single year by 2020.
John Vidal,
that's a huge gap.
What is that gap going to mean, John Vidal?
Well, the gap is getting bigger, not smaller. I mean, that's the whole point. It means that unless they come up with real cast iron assurances by October, November next year, unless we see real money on the table, these talks will collapse. I'm absolutely certain of it.
Suzanne, you're leaving Lima this afternoon, along with delegates and negotiators from around the world. What happens next?
Well, what happens next is that people have until March officially to really show what they're going to do. They have to put forward a figure for emissions reductions targets. Now, you've seen the targets coming forward from the US and from the European Union and from China. Now the pressure's on for others to begin to put forward those targets. I mean, and countries are crunching those numbers, and seeing what they can offer. And so by the end of March, hopefully we'll get an idea of how serious people are.
Quick prediction from you, John Vidal. What do you think will happen next
there's
year?
There's going to be some grotesque arm twisting, in fact, call it bullying, from the rich countries over the poor countries. And money will be offered, and there will be blood on the tracks.
Okay, Suzanne Goldenberg, John Vidal, thank you very much. We will be here. We'll monitor and see if those predictions are right here on the Global Development Podcast.
Hello, this is Jonathan Watts. I'm Latin America correspondent for The Guardian. For me, this has been a year that's been a mixture of elections on the political side, of course, the World Cup on the sports and entertainment side, but underlying them all, and dearest to my heart, it's been a story of increasing deterioration of the regional environment. And by that, I mean, we've seen more and more mining companies, hydroelectric companies, road builders, loggers, drug dealers, using the Amazon, the world's biggest forest, pushing through it and transforming some of the world's most biodiverse areas. Even in the best case scenario, all that will have happened is that the rate of deforestation has slowed down. It hasn't stopped. It's just slowed down. So more and more of the Amazon is being cleared. And certainly, I've been here in Latin America now for 2.5 years. The longer I'm here, the more often I'm visiting the Amazon, the more I'm coming to realize just how threatened it is and how it's being broken up by all of these different projects that are now taking place. And we're seeing this transformation, not just in Brazil, but in Peru and in Ecuador. So the news on the environmental front has pretty much been negative across the board, unfortunately. Some of the most striking stories of the year, although they didn't always make the front pages, have been about new infrastructure projects. And in particular, last week and the week before that, I've seen the two biggest projects in Latin America. The biggest one currently taking place is the construction of the Belo Monte hydroelectric dam in Pará State, Brazil. This is well underway, and by August next year, the engineers are saying that they will be able to close off the river, and a few months later, the first turbine will start to produce electricity, and the whole project will be finished by 2019. There's been a lot of impact already. You can see swathes of area deforested. The indigenous people have essentially given up the battle. In return, they've been compensated with new motorboats, four-wheel drives, iPods, you name it. They've been given everything that they asked for. But at the same time, they're saying, well, you've given us all these things from your culture, but we're losing the essence of our way of life, which is a running water and a means of food, because they used to fish in the river. So you're seeing a lot of destruction from that project, although it will provide a phenomenal amount of electricity, 11,000 megawatts, which Brazil definitely needs. The argument, of course, is whether that's the best way to get it, and environmentalists would definitely say no. But it is a climate-friendly, if you like, if not environment-friendly, way of producing electricity. The other really big project that I went to report on, although it hasn't yet started, is the plans for a new canal across Nicaragua. This will be a rival to the Panama Canal. It will stretch from the Atlantic to the Pacific. It will be, if it gets underway, and everybody in Nicaragua that I spoke to said it will get underway, very, very much bigger than the Panama Canal. It will be longer, more than twice as long. It will be wider. It will be deeper. And it will involve a greater removal of earth than any other project that has ever taken place, according to the engineers who are planning this. This will be an utterly transformative project. The whole GDP of Nicaragua is no more than $12 billion a year. This project alone promises at least $40 billion to go into the Nicaraguan economy. So you're going to see a transformative effect that should propel development in Nicaragua, which is the second poorest country in Latin America. But at the same time, you're going to have a huge impact on the environment, particularly Lake Nicaragua, which is the biggest source of fresh water in Central America. So these two projects, and there are many others that I could cite, but let's just concentrate on these two. For me, these are absolutely spectacular developments that are changing the face of Latin America, yes, lifting living standards, but at the same time, putting a lot of extra pressure on the environment.
My name's Emma Graham-Harrison. I'm international affairs correspondent for The Observer, but I've just moved back to the UK after living in Afghanistan for more than 4 years.
The way the Afghan was participating in the election, the turnout of the people in the polling station, women and men in bad weather condition, that was a fantastic slump on the face of enemy of Afghanistan and exactly a big punch on the face of those whom they believe Afghanistan is not ready for democracy.
So 2014 was a pretty historic year for Afghanistan because you had the first ever peaceful, largely democratic transfer of power. The outgoing president, Hamid Karzai, had ruled Afghanistan since 2001. A lot of people had expected that he would try to hold on to power one way or another, perhaps do something like Putin and Medvedev did, create a prime ministerial role for himself or arrange for a puppet candidate to win the election. But in fact, he relinquished power. However, things haven't been entirely resolved by the fact that he's handed over power, because although you have a new president, Ashraf Ghani, a very interesting man who's a former academic, but he's now got to move from the world of academia and theories into putting it into practice in a very, very difficult environment.
This is the aftermath of an attack on the Afghan intelligence agency in Jalalabad. 6 people were killed and over 40 wounded when 2 suicide car bombers...
I think he's got 2 main things on his to-do list. One is don't be defeated by the Taliban. Don't let your government collapse. It's probably the number one. And number 2 is sort out the country's finances. Afghanistan's almost bankrupt. It's heavily dependent on foreign aid. Well over half of the national budget is provided by donors. It's a very inefficient taxation system. The economy is feeble. And he also has to deal with terrible, terrible corruption. I mean, Afghanistan a couple of years ago had the world's biggest bank scandal. If you look at the size of the bank relative to national GDP, a bank called Kabul Bank nearly collapsed. The theft was nearly $1 billion, $925 million had gone missing. Ghani, one of the very first things he did when he came to office was order the arrest of 2 of the main people responsible for that, the guy who'd been chairman of the bank and another senior official. And that was a very clear way to send out a signal that he was serious about tackling corruption.
The threat here in Afghanistan was from Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda training camps. That has been removed, and that is real progress.
But the Taliban definitely see this as a chance to assert themselves militarily, to perhaps try and put the Afghan army, the Afghan police on the back foot. You know, very recently there was a day where Kabul opened the day with a suicide bombing on an army bus that killed several people. And then the day ended with another suicide bombing, this time on a play, one of the very few kind of cultural venues left in Kabul. They were actually performing a play about suicide bombings and the impact of them. And during the performance, a teenage bomber detonated a suicide vest, killing at least one person, injuring many more. And the Taliban said afterwards in a statement that they specifically targeted that play because it was sort of spreading lies about jihad and about what they were doing. So, I mean, you know, you can see with an attack like this, the Taliban are sending a very brutal but very sophisticated message.
That was Emma Graham-Harrison. And before that, Jonathan Watts in Brazil. Now to Africa. Monica Mark is the West Africa correspondent for The Guardian. She's contributed to many of our reports this year, including our coverage of Ebola. And she's on the line now. Monica, how's Nigeria coped with the outbreak?
Nigeria was basically, it was able to draw on, it's got polio surveillance system in place because it's one of the, I think, one of 3 or 4 countries in the world where polio is still endemic. So a lot of the, so that system could also be used to track people down, and I think tens of,
right. So it just had a better infrastructure to start with.
It had a better infrastructure as well, but also Nigeria, it was as well. The Liberian man, when he flew in, he went to a private clinic because doctors were on strike for much the same reason as doctors are on strike in Sierra Leone right now. They're not being paid enough. And they work in dismal conditions. So doctors happened to be on strike in public hospitals. So that meant that only one small clinic was dealing with this Ebola case, and they reacted, you know, it's hard to tell what might have been the case if Zoya had been exposed to a lot of people.
Let's broaden out a bit, because obviously the worst thing Nigeria needed, I suppose, was a medical emergency at the same time as all the other problems, particularly the security emergency that there's been throughout a lot of the year. Talk to me a bit about that and how that's evolved.
It's been a bad year for security. Nigeria's had a problem with Boko Haram in the north of the country for about 5 years now, so it's nothing new. It was this year that 200 and almost 300 schoolgirls were kidnapped. We've never seen anything on that scale before. So that was pretty terrible. But the thing is, in context, those girls being kidnapped, actually, it's not on that scale, but it's something that's happening every day. It happened earlier this week. I think about 40 women were kidnapped from a village in the north.
Once they're kidnapped, are they staying kidnapped or are they drifting back and we're just not really monitoring the story properly?
Part of the reason why Boko Haram continue unchecked is because they're almost sort of like Nigeria's dirty secret. The government, it's almost as if they want to wish it away. And people, obviously Nigeria is a country of 180 million people. It's a big country. And people are worrying about their own issues on a day-to-day level. You know, there's no infrastructure's bad. There's no electricity. Running water is patchy. So they sort of try not to think about what's going on elsewhere because it's just sort of too much.
Those girls... We all read about those girls. Their plight went around the world. Are they still or in the clutches of Boko Haram to any large degree, in large numbers?
To date, apart from girls who were able to escape in the initial hours of their school being raided, only one girl, as far as I'm aware, has been reported to have escaped. So, yeah, it's not a straightforward situation for the government because obviously, they have to consider, do they want to set a precedent for doing hostage swaps? And it's very difficult to rescue even just one person who's being held by Islamists who are not worried about killing their hostages. You know, they have nothing to lose by killing them. So obviously, if you have 200 odd girls, it's pretty much impossible to successfully rescue them. So it's tough for the government. But one thing that as far as we can tell, progress hasn't been made is in terms of dialoguing with this group. Again, it's hard to dialogue with a group that has the ideals that Boko Haram does. But as far there seem to be moderate elements in the group, and it does seem their brutality is kind of making people turn against them that initially may have sympathized with some of their ideals. And the government, we're not aware that they're reaching out to these elements, more moderate elements, and sort of making progress with them.
Is this on the front pages there in Nigeria? Isn't this a continuing scandal?
It's not front page news anymore. It's just sort of a background term. It is covered, but it's not really front page news. With the elections coming up, obviously security is going to be one of the main campaigning issues. So that might change over the next few months. And what we've seen, even just in the run up to the primaries, is a spike in bomb blasts going off in major cities rather than sort of rural areas, which is where Boko Haram have been concentrating.
Is it really possible that Goodluck Jonathan's government can go into an election with 200 odd girls kidnapped, not having got them back, and still win an election?
In Nigeria, that is entirely possible. And it's likely as well that the incumbent will win. Not least because people are sort of better the devil they know. That's kind of the attitude.
Monica, obviously you'll be looking forward to the elections in Nigeria, but what else are you looking forward to? What will be the other big stories in the region?
It's a big year for elections across Africa and West Africa in particular. Togo, Benin and Ivory Coast will be particularly interesting to watch. Their first elections since Alassane Ouattara came into power in 2011. That election basically triggered a sort of brief but pretty brutal civil conflict that was kind of the culmination of years of conflict that had been building up. So it will be interesting for the first time in a really long time to have a sort of a democratic election in Ivory Coast, to see how people feel about the incumbent, Ouattara, who was sort of, when he came in, he was a IMF, French-educated, former IMF director, a real technocrat, and people had high hopes that he could restore Ivory Coast to the position it had once been in, which was kind of the shining star of West Africa. So it'll be interesting to sort of see what issues come up around his election and how he handles that, particularly in context of Burkina Faso's recent political troubles. They've had Blaise Compaoré, who's been president for 27 years, tried to extend the constitution, and that led to his being swept out. So there's a whole generation of young people in Burkina Faso who have grown up with just one president.
I'm sure it will be good and bad, and there'll be fortunes will rise and fall. But do you go into 2015 optimistic for Africa?
Realistically, it's hard to imagine there's going to be any sort of dramatic changes. But I am hopeful that quite a lot has been learnt from what's been a quite tough year, and that will have an impact, a positive impact going forward.
Monica, thank you. I'm sure we'll hear from you on our Global Development podcast throughout 2015, but for now, thank you very much. Let's stay with West Africa, because The Guardian's health editor Sarah Bosley has just been in Sierra Leone and Liberia. She's been speaking to local health workers and NGOs on their continuing struggle against the epidemic. This is her report.
In large letters on a hoarding at a traffic junction is a public health warning. It runs, Ebola is real. A, B, C. Avoid body contact. NHS. No handshake.
We actually bring in some food items as well as non-food items to households that are quarantined. They are locked up, they cannot move out inside your food, so they rely on what we supply them.
Mori Amadou is a project manager for Plan International. He distributes food to villages in quarantine.
Are people happy to stay in their homes if they get the package of food?
The reason why people go out is for them to go in search of food, to get their daily livelihoods. If they are quarantined and they are given the appropriate support, then definitely there's no reason for them to feel bad about staying home in order to prevent the spread of the infection. That's basically why we Plan International is helping with all these food and non-food items with the support from DFID.
Is it difficult sometimes to get to these homes because they're built in places that are hard to access?
Yeah, it is. It is really very difficult, as you saw today. In fact, in most of the locations, you really have to mind your steps. It's rocky and bumpy, and the footpaths are really narrow and full of steps. So it's really difficult. There's no car access. People have to head carry the load, so we bring it as close as the street can take us to, or the car can take us, and then we go meet the people, discuss with them, give them their papers, sensitize them on the package and what it entails and the reason why we are giving the package. And then we tell them to ask their neighbors who can afford to come and help them collect their foodstuff on their behalf, and then go submit it from a distance, you know.
Sierra Leoneans are being asked to make fundamental changes to their behaviour. It goes beyond funerals, where families now know, although they do not all accept, that they must not touch the body of those who have died. A hug or a handshake is now considered dangerous. That is hard in a tactile society.
Today, I've already picked two bodies.
And what sort of people were they?
All are male. They are men.
In the western areas of Freetown, Mustafa Rogers works for the Red Cross burial teams, explaining to families why their loved ones must be taken away.
My job is BENCOM, that is beneficiary communication. I always talk to the people who lost their loved ones, encourage them, talk to them, just give them encouraging talk so that they will not feel bad of what is happening now or what has been going on in Sierra Leone, this Ebola crisis situation.
And I think you talked to them and also to all the rest of the community about the dangers of Ebola and how to keep safe.
Yes, I did that, because at any time we arrive at a community, since this Ebola breakout come in this country, we have honorables, we have other people who have been telling communities about the dangers of Ebola. So when we come as volunteer, safe and dignified burial team, we also emphasize on it again that you should keep away from Ebola, don't touch body contact. We have to tell them, you see, just for them not to come in contact of Ebola, and we break the chain. We try to cut the chain of Ebola so that the country will be free from Ebola.
Does the community get very upset when you pick up the bodies, or do they accept this now?
No, they accept us, because we as a volunteer, safe and dignified burial team, whenever we reach community, we try to talk to them in a manner so that they will not get annoyed over us. So they appreciate Sierra Leone Red Cross very much picking bodies in the communities.
This is Dr. Ramona Sunderworth, an emergency paediatric physician working in Lunsa.
I have a bit of advantage since I grew up in Brazil, but it is very hot. Even before you get into PPE, you're sweating, and then once you get into it, you 10 pieces of equipment that cover you from head to toe, including goggles and masks and gloves, double, triple sets of gloves. So it gets quite wet in there, I must say. And in the tents, where the temperature is a good 10 degrees higher than even in the ambient air, it can get quite drippy, I would say.
It isn't the usual way around that things are in medicine. The patient doesn't come first. Actually, the rest of the community comes first. Because there's no treatment, people have to be kept away if they have the virus, so the rest of us are safe. And a lot of the doctors out there struggle slightly with this. You know, this is public health rather than medicine. Obviously, everybody's doing as much as they possibly can for those people who fall ill, but they have no treatments, there are no drugs. And so at the moment, all they can do is to keep them apart.
We don't stay in there for more than 2 hours maximum, usually about an hour and a half, maybe an hour, 50 minutes. That's in the middle of the day. That's about all one can really be functional in those suits. But part of it is just staying focused on the job you're doing and being safe, being very aware of where you are, not focusing on the heat. Because the main issue is not the heat, it's the safety of the healthcare providers and the care that you're giving the patient. So that helps. That helps forget about the heat for a little while.
You can see the emotional danger they are in. They want so much to cure these young people, and the older ones too, and are investing so much by coming here that the deaths hurt badly. They can still make the odd joke about Ebola. They need to be able to. One suggests a new way to get rid of persistent but unwanted male admirers back home. Give him a kiss on the mouth and remark, "I've just come back from working in an Ebola treatment centre." But it's not just Ebola that they're fighting in Western Africa. In Liberia, Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, is about to distribute malaria tablets to almost 2,500 families living in West Point, a slum area of the capital. Malaria kills more people than Ebola, particularly pregnant women and small children. The symptoms are identical to Ebola: fever, headache, vomiting. That means there is a risk somebody suffering from malaria will end up in an isolation unit, where they may pick up the lethal virus from those who really do have it. Clément Bess Desmoulières is a logistician with MSF who has planned these early morning handouts in incredible detail.
Today's situation went pretty well. We started at 5:30, it's now 10 to 7, and we almost distribute 2,300 kits, so for 2,300 families. People were well respecting the no-touch policy, which is great, to avoid any cross-contamination. This is our main challenge.
You have to take some very serious precautions, don't you, before you come into these areas?
The challenges are about gathering people together. We have to make sure that they will not come all together after, when they reach the distribution spot, to make sure they will not push each other, rush, fight, and especially touch each other and trying to avoid as much as possible any contact. This is for all the beneficiaries, but on the other side, for the people that are working on the site, the distributor, the sensitization team, drivers, supervisor, is to protect themselves from any contact as well. So we are following very strict rules of protection, prevention, with some safe area where we're working in. We have some buffer area to avoid any direct contact with the people, especially at the distribution point.
And what is the reason for doing this? Is it just to do with malaria, or is it about Ebola?
It's both in one. So malaria is still a illness who is killing a lot of people every year. Also, malaria, first symptoms like fever and weakness and vomiting are quite similar than the Ebola. So first of all, that was to help the Ebola treatment unit to have less people in the triage center and in the transit center. Now the idea also is to avoid cross-contamination for people who are suspected Ebola but who actually get only malaria. And in case they are brought to the suspected area, they can be contaminated and become some Ebola cases.
MSF tells its staff, don't touch anybody, don't touch anything, don't sit down. It's not as easy as it sounds. A small crowd of women gather as I speak to one or two and move in close. Then one of them, impatient of my attempts to understand the spelling of her name, grabs my pen and writes it in my notebook. Does it matter? Very likely not, but I felt obliged to spray the pen with chlorinated water afterwards, as well as the hand she touched.
Sarah Bosley there, and you can follow her Ebola diary at theguardian.com/global-development.
I'm David Smith. I'm the Africa correspondent of The Guardian, and I'm based in Johannesburg, South Africa. 2014, the narrative of Africa rising, as it's often described, really continued. There are many conferences for investors where they like to hold up the cover of The Economist magazine from 2000, which described Africa as a hopeless continent. And then about a decade later, a headline, Africa Rising, or the Hopeful Continent. And particularly in terms of development, I think the two stars that are often held up as models tend to be Ethiopia and Rwanda. Both of these countries have done very well on many of the Millennium Development Goals. Rwanda in particular, slashing maternal mortality and great improvements in education and on other counts. What, of course, does not get mentioned at these conferences, even the words are almost taboo, are issues like democracy and human rights. And human rights watchdogs are extremely critical of both the Ethiopian and Rwandan governments. What we also are very concerned to watch and worry about is the ongoing conflicts in the Central African Republic and South Sudan. In December, it will be 1 year in South Sudan since the outbreak of civil war, and there's been a slight lull in the fighting, really because of the weather due to seasons, but a lot of the international aid agencies are warning that they expect a resurgence in fighting there. And I should also mention Kenya. The president, Uhuru Kenyatta, had charges against him dropped at the International Criminal Court. In the meantime, a year after the terrible attack on the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, there was no let-up from the Al-Shabaab militants. More attacks, dozens of people killed in cold blood, sort of raising questions about the Kenyan military operation in Somalia. Despite that, actually, you could argue Somalia was very unusually one of the happier notes of 2014. Still, some terrible atrocities going on, but actually in Mogadishu itself, a gradual, incremental change for the better. Journalists love writing stories about the first florist, the first laundrette. This year we saw the first cash ATM in Mogadishu, and I think the first postal service for 20 years. But clearly still a long way to go there, despite the glimpses of optimism.
I'm Alex Duval-Smith. I did a podcast in September looking at how corruption is affecting development in Mali.
There have also been some flaws.
You're referring to the presidential jet?
Yeah, the presidential jet. So it's created a lot of talks around it.
The podcast looked at the impact of the purchase by the Malian government of a presidential jet and the extension of a credit facility of $200 million for the purchase of defense equipment. This irritated the donors, in particular the IMF, which froze its direct budgetary support to the Malian government. Mainly looks like accountants are now happy with the 2014 books that Mali can present. It's not entirely clear that the government is going to be any more transparent in future, even though it's pledged that it will be.
We, the IMF, we don't generally take issue with specific spending items, but you can imagine if you're a donor, you may want to reconsider your budget support.
In the podcast, we heard from Anton Opdebeker, who's the representative of the IMF here in Mali, and he's become quite a celebrity. He's seen by local civil society groups as really having produced the biggest shock to Ibrahim Boubacar Keita's government since it was elected in August 2013. Another person we heard from was Kumba Ba. Interestingly, Kumba Ba has now moved on to have quite a prominent role in civil society, leading a good governance NGO, which is making waves.
Yes, the Malian diaspora sent a lot of money in, but I have a feeling that 90% of the money that is sent by diaspora is all eaten for no business development whatsoever.
I think it's going to be interesting to watch the extent to which aid manages to penetrate northern Mali. There are attempts, constant attempts, to restart work on a road which is EU-funded, which will eventually connect Bamako and Timbuktu on tar, which is very important for the opening up of northern Mali. And in the process of opening up northern Mali, development aid but also investment can reach the north. At the moment, the north is still very much in the hands of smugglers and a parallel economy which essentially dominates the north.
But has anybody done an evaluation, an audit of the productivity and the meeting of a goal? We put 30 billion in this agricultural sector to have this much done in rice. Can we go and see if that rice has been produced? And if the rice has been produced, is it been stocked properly? What is meant to be shifted out of the country, sold to have value added? Is that being done? But the government just sit and send you a report.
Since the election of Ibrahim Boubacar Keita at the end of 2013, Mali's emerged very much as a country whose hand is being held by France and the international community, both in terms of its sovereignty, its defence, and its development aid. The government has no social programs whatsoever. It would be interesting to see if more pressure was put on the government to live up to, for example, the Abuja Declaration, to spend more money on social issues such as health, such as education, which still very much are considered, it seems, by the government as somebody else's problem, in other words, the international community's problem.
That was Alex Duval-Smith, and you can follow her stories from Mali on Twitter. That's at Alex Duval-Smith. As for our estimable Africa correspondent David Smith, you can follow him. That's at Smith in Africa. And that's it for this roundup of 2014. Remember, all of our programmes from this year are still available on theguardian.com/global-development and on iTunes, SoundCloud and all podcasting apps. We'll be back in January. My name's Hugh Muir. The producer is Matt Hill. Thanks for listening in 2014, and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.